Welcome to the Visual Impact Podcast, bringing you conversations and insights from the world of filmmaking. I'm Rob Newton, and today we are talking to Director of Photography David Proctor about his early career and his work on the Netflix original drama The Innocents. If you haven't seen it, this supernatural drama follows teenagers Harry and June as they elope from their repressive families, only to find their journey derailed by an extraordinary discovery. David, welcome to the podcast and thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for reaching out.
It's okay. Before we move on to The Innocents, which is great, by the way, I was watching it over the last couple of weeks as sort of research for this podcast, and it's very good. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Perhaps you could start by just telling us a little bit about your background in the industry.
Okay, well, I really started out in documentary. I moved to London after my time at studying film school. And I don't have one of those romantic backstories of, you know, stealing my family's camera and running into a forest and deciding to be a filmmaker. I really didn't discover any passion for sort of storytelling and filmmaking until I was at art school at Ravensbourne when I was 19, where we started shooting and developing 35mm film.
Yep.
And that grabbed me immediately. And from there, we started moving forward into sort of lens-based media and making small films and experimental films. And that was where I sort of first realized that this career even existed, to be honest. My background was more academic focused, and I was never exposed to the world of cinematography.
Sure.
So that sort of began my journey of pursuing it as a career. So moving forwards from that, I went to Hull School of Art and Design to a course that no longer exists, which specialized in cinematography and directing. And then moved to London with no connections in the industry at all.
Yeah, it was quite a bold move, really, moving down to London when you didn't know anyone and didn't have any connections.
Well, it felt like the only option to move to the heart of the industry in the UK and to move forwards from there. I felt that by being in London, I could be in the right place to make the right contacts.
Sure.
So I started working closely with a local camera house.
Yeah.
I started assisting and working in documentary and all the while selling coffee machines on the side as a freelancer, trying to sort of pay the bills and survive in London. Things grew from there, really. So the documentary work continued and I began getting exposure there. And I used the European Film Festival circuit to travel as much as I could afford to and meet directors and producers in that way, which was a fantastic way of networking and sort of, you know, getting my connections, you know, slightly more broadly across the European film industry.
Excellent. And so after those experiences, then how would you describe your approach as a cinematographer? Is it from a creative perspective, a very technical perspective? How would you describe it?
I would say that my decisions always come from the script. The narrative is always the king, and every decision I make, whether it be composition or lighting, camera movement, for me has to come from the script. It has to be narratively driven.
Yeah.
And that's been the foundation of sort of everything I've done from the outset, whether you are working with a handheld camera, whether you are working with an aerial shot, or whatever the technique you're using, for me has to come from the script.
Right. And what were some of your earlier influences, would you say? I mean, obviously you said you didn't have a background in, you didn't have a family that was in the business, as it were. So what were your earlier influences, would you say?
Well, I think something interesting happened during my sort of years of education, which was that I became aware of this world of film that was completely alien to me until that point, which was the sort of European and sort of world art house cinema circuit.
Okay.
And it was just a style and a genre of film that I had never been exposed to. So I had never seen that kind of slightly more alternative approach to filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And I was really grabbed by some particular works from Andrei Zviagintsev. I remember when I first saw his film, The Return, and then The Banishment. Krzysztof Kozlowski's early work. Well, Krzysztof Kozlowski's entire body of work, to be honest. Iñárritu's early work, sort of Amores Perros, 21 Grams, Beautiful, films of the Dardenne brothers. And they were films that struck me with the realism, this raw realism that they captured, which was so different to anything I'd seen, you know, growing up going to the cinema or on television. And that really captured my imagination to this whole sort of other approach of cinema. Sure. You know, the fact that cinema could be such a powerful tool of you know, political and social commentary.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, and both your debut features, Bypass and Blood Cells, were premiered at the Venice Film Festival. That must have been quite special for you.
Yeah, that was quite overwhelming, actually. I didn't expect that, and to be out there, and it's a very surreal thing. I find any film premiere, I find very surreal, because the blood and sweat that goes into filmmaking, and suddenly you're in this, you know, completely different environment, sort of transplanted into it.
Yeah.
And you're in this place where often for the first time, a large group of people are seeing your work and reacting to it. And I always find that very, very exciting and sort of nerve-wracking as well.
Yes.
But it was an amazing platform for both films.
Yeah, and of course, Bypass was nominated at Cameron Mirage for Best Cinematography Debut.
That was a huge honour. I'd previously had documentary and music video work at Camera Image, so it was a dream of mine to be there with a feature, and I felt hugely honoured for that nomination, and just to be able to share the film with so many of my peers, and it was a wonderful experience.
Yeah. So after that sort of really early success, did you think, oh well, this is it? This is quite easy. I've my, you know, debut features at a great film festival. Do you think, well, you know, bring on Bond or bring on something else, you know, from a big?
I think yes. I think you've touched on something very interesting, which is one of the pitfalls which many fall into is that feeling of, you know, you suddenly have this idea that, great, I've made it. This is it. It's happening. Yeah. Who knows what's next? Mm-hmm. And the reality is that within cinematography, that rarely exists. It really is a very, very long ladder with very small steps. And you're just constantly climbing and doing your best to climb to the next step. But even with Venice, there was no big substantial step forward in my career from that moment of having two films at Venice, or you hope that there will be. And then always in hindsight, you look back and think, ah, okay, it wasn't that big a thing. you keep pushing forwards. And I think that's something that throughout my career there's been a number of moments in my career where you feel, great, this is going to elevate things. This is going to move things forward more quickly. This will accelerate everything. And it rarely does. It's just a constant trajectory. You just keep pushing forwards.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. That's brilliant. So let's move on to the Netflix supernatural drama then, The Innocents, which, as I say, I've been watching and catching up on. And you were the cinematographer and shot all 8 episodes. Is that right?
So I shot episodes 1 to 4 and then 7 and 8, and I co-shot episodes 5 and 6 with cinematographer Damien Paul.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what attracted you to the project when you read the script? Was it the narrative?
I met Farron, the director. And I really loved his vision of this Scandi noir thriller, sort of, but grounded in reality. I think that was something that really hooked me from my first meeting with Farron was the fact that what read on the page is something quite fantastical in this, you know, sci-fi world was actually not that wasn't what Farron wanted to do with the project. He wanted to keep it very real, keep it very very grounded. And that was something that definitely appealed to me, because I think had he not wanted to go down that route, down that road with it, I don't think it would have been a project I would have been able to join. So it was a very exciting prospect to tell such a unusual fictional story in a way that felt plausible and grounded.
Sure. And obviously that's very important to you in terms of your style as well, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely prefer a sort of a heightened reality rather than anything that feels too constructed.
Yeah.
That's a very large generalization. But
sure. Excellent. And I believe there was two directors worked on it. Had you worked with both of them before?
No, so we had Farron Blackburn directing 1 to 4 and then 7 and 8. And then we had Jamie Donoghue directing 5 and 6. I'd not worked with either of them before, so it was a first. Mm-hmm. It was a great experience working with both of them. They have different approaches, as we all do.
Yeah.
But it was a very interesting experience for me. Because it was my first TV drama, mm-hmm. You know, sequential series. And it was my first time stepping from one director to another. And on a show like that, as a cinematographer, you do have a lot on your shoulders of maintaining an aesthetic, maintaining a visual language that's already been set. So something that Farron and I had spent a lot of time doing during prep was designing our visual language and the grammar of how we were covering scenes. And that was something that we adhered to very strictly. And then when Jamie stepped in, Jamie's a brilliant director with lots of ideas. And sometimes his ideas were outside of the remit of what we had sort of created in our, let's say, aesthetic rule book. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a sort of very challenging, interesting conversation, how you manage that to sort of maintain some aesthetic consistency with the show. And that was my first time doing that. You know, I think a lot of drama DPs do that all the time. But for me, it was my first time having to kind of wrangle ideas and become a collaborator in a slightly different way than I might normally be.
Yeah. And as you say, both directors, I'm sure, brought different things to it. And some things you probably thought, yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Or some that might be, oh, it's a bit different. Let's try that. But as you say, you've got to keep the overall holistic approach to the whole thing and say, well, no, it's got to have the same style, same feel from episode 1 all the way through to episode 8.
That's it. You don't want any episode standing out in an episodic series. You want there to be a consistency. You want an audience to know where they are, how things should feel, the language. You don't want sudden drastic changes. That can be very jarring. And as such can then detract from the narrative, and become, you know, detrimental.
Sure.
Yeah.
And how did you decide on the visual look and the style of the series right at the beginning?
Well, I touched on already about the, mm-hmm. the naturalism, the idea of keeping things grounded, and by keeping the light direction and the feeling of the lighting naturally motivated, that hopefully made the on-screen sort of drama that unfolds more plausible, mm-hmm. Because it's happening in a world that feels relatable to us as an audience as we watch. And that was integral to what we wanted to do. Moving forwards from that into the sort of actual language of what we did, Farron is a big believer of being closer to characters. He much prefers to be with characters on slightly wider lenses rather than sort of lensed up from a distance. So being present with the characters was something that we were bought into from the outset. And slightly broad, more broadly speaking, the language, the grammar of the series, Farron always felt that a lot of the show should be handheld. That was something he said to me very early on. But we both felt that Sanctum in the Norwegian island needed to be different, and it needed to be, have its own language, its own identity. And for us, that immediately felt like it needed a sense of calm, because it is a microcosm of calm in the narrative. It is a place of safety, a place of shelter for these people. So we decided early on that we would go on Styx, Dolly, Slider in Norway, and then we would go handheld off the island per se. But that wasn't quite enough for me or for Farron. We didn't feel that that was quite layered enough in terms of being from the script. We needed to justify it to ourselves. Mm-hmm. It felt intrinsically correct, but it didn't feel justified fully. So we sort of started digging deeper into the motivations of what had got us there, as, you know, artistically, what had got us to that place. And we realized that it really all hinged on Halvorsen, Guy Pearce's character. And the calmness of the island all came from him. The Sanctum as an entity was all his doing. So that calmness actually emanated from Halvorsen's character. So we ended up designing the aesthetic around him. So basically, when he's on the island and he's in control, everything's very calm, very still, very classical. And when he's not, and when the island starts to fall apart and he starts to lose control, that handheld aesthetic that we've seen in the UK starts to develop on the island itself. Right. And you see a very sort of large shift in the aesthetic at that point. And the same applies for when Halvorsen travels to London to meet June's character. It's the first time you've ever seen June on screen not handheld. It's the first time she suddenly feels calm and feels secure, and he takes her under her wing. He takes her under his wing and then takes her back to Norway. So it was a very interesting thing for us to play with, that kind of use of handheld and sort of static, solid camera work.
Yeah, and you didn't go for the stereotypical cool blue portrait of Norway, did you? It was a lot warmer.
That's right. We decided to sort of move against that sort of stereotypical aesthetic of Norway, and we wanted to push sort of more brown tones and warmer tones into the rocks. We felt somehow it made the island feel more remote, pulling the tones of the rocks out and desaturating the greens. We felt we made it feel slightly more rugged, slightly more wild, which I think in hand makes the place feel even sort of more isolated.
Yeah. Yeah. And it certainly looked, you know, a lot of the landscape, you know, photography was fantastic. It really, and I was just wondering if a lot of people said to you, you know, can I go there? Is it a place I can actually visit?
It is a place. It's not a place you can visit. It's privately owned. It's a very, very difficult. It's very difficult to get to. Right. I mean, it was a substantial logistical challenge for production. To facilitate the shoot there. It's sort of 2 hours north of Bergen in the fjords, and it's close to nothing. it's quite an adventure.
Yeah, I can imagine. Because as you said, touching on the various locations, you shot a lot of it obviously in Norway and the UK in some studio. So what challenges did that bring in terms of moving different locations and also contending with the weather, etc.?
Well, we did 7 weeks of studio in the UK. We did 6 weeks in Norway, and the rest was around location in the UK, in Yorkshire in the southeast.
Okay.
The main logistical challenge really within all of it was the island in Norway. We had to, our unit base was two industrial barges chained together in the fjord. There had to be access built up the back of the island so that we could travel to and from set each day without damaging the island itself. Mm-hmm. That area of Norway is extremely wet. I believe Bergen is quoted to be the wettest city in the world, and that's the nearest city. So we had, I would say, almost constant rain for our time there for 6 weeks. So you can imagine a large film crew moving around a small island. It became very difficult to preserve the terrain.
Sure.
So that was very, very difficult. But yeah, crew traveled to set each day by boat. We had like a network of ribs running back and forth, taking crew to and from set, cast and crew. And our unit base was this floating sort of island attached to the island. And we'd travel up the back through this kind of excavated road, scaffold road up the back of the island to set each day. It was very, very unique and exciting experience. A lovely way to start every day, it really was.
Yes, I was going to say it's a sort of story that sounds really good at dinner parties, but not so good when you're out there trying to film in the constant rain and the cold.
Yeah, I mean, huge respect to my team, particularly of the lighting team. The Sparks had a really tough time. Moving equipment and machines around the island was very challenging. Yep. Cable runs, power, Jenny's, but I mean, everything you can imagine. It was inhospitable and extremely wet. I think most of the guys ended up in deep sea fishing gear because of the rain that was just nonstop.
Yeah. Again, I think it's, things like that start off, it's quite a laugh, isn't it? You think, oh yeah, this is great, we'll be fine. But weeks in, and then, on week five or week six, you think, I've had enough of this.
Yeah, we certainly all discovered that clothes are not waterproof for very long. Yeah. unless it's full plastic, it doesn't matter what you wear. It's the water will get through eventually.
So, sure.
I think the whole crew, they saw the Norway section of the shoot as this very unusual challenge, and sort of embraced it. And it really was my favorite part of the shoot, despite the challenges, despite the hardship of it. It was so unique an experience that you sort of relished every day, even with the challenges and the cold and the wet. But it was an amazing experience.
Brilliant. And did you shoot with two cameras off? No, you were saying about handheld, but were the two cameras involved?
Yeah, it was a two camera shoot throughout. I had Rob Arrowsmith on A camera, and I took B camera. We ran two cameras almost exclusively, unless there was a very solid reason not to. Like sometimes we'd be on sort of Steadicam sequences with Rob, and there wasn't really a place for B camera to play, so I would step down. But generally, yes, we shot two cameras all the time.
Okay, and did that present any challenges in maintaining your specific style?
There can be compromises with two cameras. But generally, we use the two in a complementary way. So we rarely cross shot. We avoided that really at all times, so that we were always shooting complementary angles. Inherently, it pushes one angle off an eye line a bit wider than you might want to be, but we embraced it. We made it work, and I don't feel that there was any detriment really. It allowed us to get through the schedule.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned Rob Arrowsmith. Were there any other members of your regular team who were working on the project?
Yeah, so I'm Damien Poole, second unit DP and co-DP of episodes 5 and 6. Damien and I have been working together since 2010. Oh. So that was fantastic to have him on board. Mm. He was also second unit DP on Blood Cells and Bypass. So we've got a long sort of history of working together. I also had Sol Sehati, gaffer. We've been working together since, I believe, 2008, if I remember correctly. So again, another great long-term collaborator. So it was wonderful to have those people around me. My DIT, Mark Kozlowski, we've worked together again nearly 10 years. I think really since the outset, the invention of the DIT role, he was one of the early DITs. Various others in the camera team and lighting team, people I'd worked with. I've tried to pull as many of my sort of regulars on that I could.
Yeah.
And onto a crazy journey. It's quite daunting. It's quite daunting bringing a lot of my sort of regular sort of commercial team onto a 125 day shoot, because that's quite a commitment to make.
Yes. Yeah. And I believe it was shot in 8K for a 4K HDR finish.
That's correct.
Yeah. Had you worked with 8K before? Was there a reason that you wanted it to be that resolution?
So the shooting, the resolution wasn't a factor for me. It was actually just to allow us to use the full sensor of the helium. We knew we were finishing in 4K, and just by shooting 8K, you're able to use the full size of the sensor, the helium sensor. So it purely became a photographic thing rather than a resolution chasing
thing. Yeah, because I think a lot of people can get sort of lost down that technical route, can't they, of it's got to be this, it's got to be, you know, in terms of the technicalities, they're ticking off a box almost, some people, in terms of the resolution.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's our job as cinematographers as well, not to be knowledgeable of the technology, yeah, but not to get too bogged down within it. I think one can easily get swamped with the technicalities of things.
Sure. And the 4K HDR finish, how did that affect the shooting and the grading process afterwards?
So I did tests with Thomas Irby, our colorist from The Look, and yep, we were the first, I believe I'm correct in saying, we were the first 4K Dolby Vision show on outside of the US at the time, I believe, or certainly we were on Netflix. So there was a good amount of time put aside for testing in the lead up to principal photography. So we shot some tests, and then we took them through the grade. We graded in HDR. And then the big concern for me from the outset was the trim pass down to SDR, because what you deliver to Netflix is the HDR master, and then you deliver this trim pass with limited control to tweak, and that is the SDR version. And what we did know at this time was that most of our audience worldwide would be seeing the SDR trim. And my concern was that we delivered this beautiful HDR master, and then people were seeing something that was an inferior version of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So getting an understanding of how this trim pass works was integral to our testing. And I must say that Thomas and I were both very relieved at how good the trim pass was and how similar an aesthetic we were able to get between the HDR and the SDR versions. So that testing process was extremely comforting, I would say, before shooting. But what it also did is it also highlighted problems and things to look out for. Yep. Within the HDR process, things that I liked, things I didn't like. So we quickly saw that we would be changing the highlight roll off nits level on a scene by scene basis.
Right.
We can maybe talk a bit more about that later. I think you had
wanted
to cover post a bit more later, but
yeah,
it made it very apparent what I needed to be wary of on set. And one of those key things was any overexposure is extremely unforgiving in HDR. So any clipped highlights, mm-hmm, be it cloud detail or practicals in shot, you really need to be mindful of where and how you're doing that, because it's a lot more distracting than it might be with an SDR finish if it's not handled correctly.
Yeah.
So I feel we did handle it correctly, and it was just something that we were aware of.
Sure. I mean, that must be the worst thing in the world, to produce something that's quite beautiful, and when people sit and watch it, it's not quite the vision that you imagined it would be.
I think it's something that we face on a daily basis as cinematographers. You see, sure, people seeing your work in an inferior way, and it's something that one can never really get used to or accept, but we have to. I think what Netflix have done with their partnership with Dolby Vision has been a fantastic first step in that, mm-hmm, in the right direction. The fact that the Dolby Vision within the Netflix app will actually take control of your smart TV and correct the settings, mm, is an amazing advancement in technology.
Yeah, clever.
And I'll be honest, when it first came out on Netflix, I believe at the time it was 40 or something countries it was released in simultaneously. And it took me about 24 hours to actually press play on my own TV, because I was too scared of it looking wrong or not looking as I thought it should.
Yes.
And when I did press play, it was as if I was sat in the grade. So I was very, very, very happy and relieved. Yeah. So that was a new experience for me, because generally speaking, you know, it never looks quite as you hoped it would, or, you know, unless you're on a calibrated screen. But the fact that it's the first step into calibrating your screen, the way that the Dolby Vision's working with Netflix, I think it's an amazing, amazing positive step forward.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. And how did you monitor the HDR on set?
So I made the decision not to monitor in HDR. And the reason for that was because of this, the way that HDR monitors stretch the image to fill the range of the monitor. For me, HDR was always a canvas, and I knew that I did not want to use that upper level very often. So unless I had live grading, which we didn't have the facility to do, I felt that it would actually be misleading to monitor an HDR on our set. So having shown my director Farron with Thomas Irby, having shown him the HDR process, the trim pass process, and him having a full understanding of it, we felt much more comfortable moving forwards in with SDR monitoring, with a lookup table that worked for SDR. And we knew that we knew where we'd take that later.
Sure. So now we're on the subject of kits. What were the cameras and lenses that you used?
So we used two red Heliums. Okay. And with that, we used a set of Zeiss super speeds, and we filled in the other lens sizes missing with standard speeds, Zeiss standard speeds. So it was a mixed set of vintage Zeiss primes.
Okay. And how did you find the combination of the vintage glass with the modern digital sensors?
I love imperfection. I find imperfection interesting. And I love the fact that I love the flare characteristics of those lenses, and I love the fall off and the way that they are slightly softer, and I find that very complimentary for an 8K resolution camera. I find you just take the edge off, it softens it.
Yep.
And for me, it feels a gentler, more natural image.
Mm-hmm. Could you just describe sort of basically how you use the lighting and the lens selection to tell the story?
So I touched on earlier Farron's preference to being close to the characters. You know, he prefers to be wider and closer. So that became something that we used throughout the series, throughout, really relevant to all characters. The lighting was always naturally motivated. Again, pushing for that slightly more real feeling aesthetic. So really it was a directional soft light was the weapon of choice for us. There is very little actually natural light, just because of, you know, the complexities of the spaces we are working in, our locations. We use composition as a tool to manipulate the audience, and a way of exploring the psychological positions of our characters. Tools like exaggerated headroom, short sighting, and sometimes finding an unusual composition can give a feeling of unease that actually resonates with an audience subliminally.
Sure. Yeah.
Rather than just sitting everything very classically, mm-hmm. you know, one can feel too comfortable within a scene, I find. So that was kind of something we reached on throughout production.
It's quite interesting actually how small things that probably the audience don't even realize is happening, or the way you say position people and the lighting can make such an effect on the audience without them knowing, you know, without them thinking, oh, well, that looks a bit straight. You know, it's just all psychological, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the goal for me is always that the cinematography, any techniques one uses as a cinematographer, to manipulate the audience. I think the goal for me is that that is an invisible sleight of hand.
Yeah.
That you, you achieve your manipulation of emotions and motivations, but without an audience being aware that that's been done. And I think that's one of the most important things that we do as cinematographers, particularly drawing back to what I said earlier about everything coming from the script is, you know, how can you tell this story the most powerful way visually, and how can you heighten things and move things forward and say more with a composition than just capturing a performance.
Yeah, sure. That's brilliant. And what were the prep and shooting schedules like? What were they like? Because often on these sort of shoots, it's quite tight, isn't it?
Yes, we had 6 weeks prep for a 25-week shoot. So that was 8 episodes, 450-plus pages of narrative.
Yeah.
It worked out, broadly speaking, at 4 days prep per episode. Right. Including scouting.
Okay, that's incredible, especially when you look at the VFX sequences, the motion control, difficult locations. You add all that together, and that's very tough, isn't it?
Yeah, it was very, very challenging to get everything done within that time. And in fact, you can't get everything done within that time. So what ended up being sort of solution for Farron and I was that our prep became more in broad strokes. So often, rather than breaking every scene down, we didn't have time to break every scene down and discuss every scene. But what we would do is we would discuss characters, we would discuss narrative arcs, we would discuss emotions of scenes. And that broader approach helped us design this visual language, which we then had as a kind of blueprint for the whole show that we could reach for at any moment. So we kind of knew, I think I touched on earlier, this handheld versus dolly track slider sort of thing. There were other layers to that too, that we knew. So we weren't looking at a scene going, oh God, you know, do we want to be on a dolly here? Do we want to be on a wide lens of it? Do we want to, you know, it was very quick. We very quickly knew what we wanted to do because we'd had that broad discussion ahead. Yep. So we knew our general approach, which I think helped hugely. And it made it possible, really, because you don't have time to go through every single scene and discuss everything in detail. And I think something else, which was, it's kind of an inevitability with a shoot that's as long as this, is that, you know, you lose locations along the way. So stuff you have prepped is thrown out and you suddenly having to try and see new locations and scout new places during shooting. And all of those challenges, there's surprises and curveballs every day. No doubt. But, my relationship with Farron and Jamie was really great. And, they were wonderful to collaborate with. And, we always found a way. So.
Yeah, I guess that adds to the freshness of the whole thing, doesn't it? Whereas if everything, you know, can become very stale if you overthink every single shot.
Yeah, I think something I would also touch on is the way that Farron and Jamie worked with the cast was fantastic on this. You know, he really, I talk mainly about Farron here, but because Farron really spent a lot of time exploring the emotions and characters of the characters with the cast. So he would have these long conversations with Guy Pearce or with Purcell or Sorica about how the scene might move and how things might develop and the blocking. And it became a very collaborative process. So with actors of that caliber, they had invested a lot into their characters and they brought a lot to the table. And that process of blocking and working scenes out became very collaborative, and that was very refreshing. So if you've gone into a scenes with too much of a fixed idea of how things should be, you're not leaving yourself open to those developments that can happen with all these different artists in one place, bringing different ideas to the table.
I hope this is not a plot spoiler, but obviously reflections and mirrors are an integral part of the story. How did you prep and shoot for those scenes?
Yeah, so there's a lot of the show takes place within mirrors. And something that I was very aware of, having done a fair amount of reflection work in the past, particularly on Bypass, actually, there was quite a lot of mirror work. I was very aware of the ghosting problems of sort of domestic mirrors. So I requested that production design switch out any mirrors within the show that we were using sort of substantially for first surface mirrors, which removes the ghosting, and it means that optically I'm able to go on any lens within it and achieve a good reflective image, good clean sharp reflective image, which I think became very, very important, especially when you've got long emotional scenes taking place within reflections. You don't want to be looking at a ghosted, almost blurred image, so that was very important. But I think on a far more creative level, that's very practical. On a far more creative level, the script dictated certain geography from spaces for scenes to work. So often there needs to be spaces where one character wouldn't be able to see another character within a mirror from certain angles, but then they move to a different space in the room and then they can see a character in a reflection. And so the design of spaces and the layout became a collaborative sort of discussion between myself, Farron, and our production designer, Donal Woods, during prep. So we built models of some of the key sets and key locations and sort of looked at different options of where mirrors could be within a space that firstly worked on a practical level for the narrative, and secondly worked within the space that would be believable. So that was, Donal, myself and Farron bouncing the ideas around, and that they then became scenes that we often did storyboard, and we often did work out very carefully how things would play out, because with the mirror in slightly the wrong place in a room, a whole scene becomes impossible to shoot. So that was a fun challenge. And there were some curveballs, definitely, as we started realizing where we needed reflections and then where we needed to avoid reflections as well.
Brilliant. And with the limited prep time it had, how did you manage to keep everything on track? It must have been a logistical nightmare, I would have thought.
It does become somewhat of a full-time job. I think, your days off become prepping for the week ahead, just trying to catch up. And I touched on earlier the fact that, inherently locations get lost. Sometimes locations are not even there anymore, or from our first day scouting to our last day shooting, it's probably spanned 9 months, so a lot can change within spaces in that time. So there was a lot of pre-calls and meetings after wrap and additional scouting. Sure. But I think broadly speaking, the keeping on track, my team were fantastic. My gaffer and my best boy, they were all over everything. My camera team, Rob, and our producer, Chris Croucher, he was incredibly supportive, and he really was all over every single detail of the script. Something else I didn't touch on was, of course, that the scripts develop as you're shooting. So we were getting new drafts of scripts every couple of days, which again becomes very challenging because you don't necessarily have time when you're shooting to stop and read two new drafts of two of the scripts, particularly when something I think that was quite unusual about our schedule, which I should touch on, was the fact that we didn't shoot in continuity, which I know one would never shoot in continuity, but at least I'm talking even in episodic continuity. I believe on day 100 of the shoot, we hadn't yet wrapped a single episode. So, so every day involved shooting scenes from different episodes. So our script supervisor, Phil Tro, was an unbelievable asset in managing that. And, it was kudos to the team across the board, really, for supporting and making it possible. From my side of things, it really was by doing that broad strokes prep with Farron that sort of got me through. The fact that we'd had so many of those conversations before and ahead, but it was very challenging.
Yeah. Moving on to the pre-production, what pre-production testing were you able to do?
So we did fairly extensive camera tests with the lenses and looking at different environments, day interior, day exterior, night interior, night exterior. We took those through the grade. I touched on earlier our HDR grade testing, the testing of the Dolby Vision trim pass. I also tested various optical low pass filters on the Helium to see if I liked anything better than what Red was supplying. In the end, we decided to go with Red's the standard. And we also tested filtration. And yeah, part of those camera tests were testing hair and makeup on the cast. So it was kind of the standard testing, really, I think.
Sure. And what would you say was your favourite scene? And could you just give us an idea of how you shot it?
Yeah, I think a scene that stands out for me that I really enjoyed was, it's the beginning of episode 4 when Halverson, Guy Pearce's character Halverson, it's his backstory really of how he first meets Runa in a mental care home. And we wanted to do something slightly more heightened. We wanted to take it slightly more theatrical than we had been elsewhere. And we felt we had license to do that because of its flashback nature of the scene. So we shot that in a abandoned hospital building somewhere in West London. And we shot day for night and dusk for night sort of thing. And it was a full day's pre-lighting for the rigging team. Pretty substantial lighting setup. We had a few hundred K of tungsten coming through the windows, and it was just a really emotionally charged scene. And it was a scene that I'd been looking forward to shooting for a long time. And it just all came together so well. The performances were fantastic, really powerful. The space worked beautifully. The kind of stark emptiness of this mental care home on sort of Christmas Eve or around Christmas late in the evening. It just had a wonderful mood to it. And I thought the cast brought amazing performances to the table. And yeah, it's a scene I'm really, really proud of.
Brilliant. Well, as I say, I really enjoyed, as I say, catching up on Netflix with it. So it was good. Maybe if we can move on a little bit, because I believe you've recently wrapped your first Hollywood studio film, Black Beauty. Is that right?
Yes, that is right.
I was just wondering if there's anything you can tell us about the project, because I know it hasn't come out yet. It's still in post, is it?
It is. It's in post now. So it's written and directed by Ashley Avis, who is a LA-based writer-director. And it's a new contemporary adaptation of Anna Sewell's novel Black Beauty, now set in contemporary US, with beauty originating now as being a wild horse. So it's quite a different approach from the 1990s film that was released. We shot on location in South Africa and New York. And I wrapped in South Africa just before Christmas, and then New York in February, I believe. Stars Mackenzie Foy, Ian Glenn, and Kate Winslet. And yeah, it's in post now. So,
were your regular team in South Africa the ones you used on The Innocents?
So I was able to take Damien Poole down, and he was my A camera operator. So Damien was the only person from my team that I was able to take down. Everyone else I worked with, local talent in South Africa. I've shot commercials in Cape Town quite a lot over the last decade. So I was able to bring in some of my regular team there, and a lot of new collaborators. And I was very lucky to have a absolutely world-class team across the board. Very, very fortunate in my team. Everyone was strong.
And obviously you're working with horses. Everyone says don't work with children and animals, but you decided to go for horses. I mean, was that very challenging as well?
Yes. We had an amazing horse team and an amazing liberty trainer working with the horses called Cody Rawson Harris, who really was able to achieve the impossible with our horses. He's like a real life horse whisperer kind of character. But invariably horses are horses. They are not actors. They don't necessarily do marks. If they do marks, they're still huge animals. You have to approach things. You have to approach things in a slightly more forgiving approach. Yeah. So whether that's with composition or with lighting, you plan as best you can that the horse will do exactly what you need, but it might do something slightly different, which actually might not make a huge difference for the scene narratively, but might make a huge difference for the scene photographically, because horses are very big animals. So working within stables, small spaces, it can be very, very difficult to get what you need from the horses. But Cody was incredible, and the cast were also extremely dedicated to the craft and to riding. All the key cast that were required to ride did ride. They spent a lot of time training, particularly Mackenzie and Ian. Ian spent a good amount of time with Cody in prep before the shoot, basically learning the basics of horse whispering and how one breaks a horse, and how you build that trust and a relationship with a horse in a ring. And Ian's dedication to that was amazing. And we actually shot a sequence where he basically for real did essentially go through the motions of breaking a horse in a ring. And we filmed it for an extended period. I think it probably was about 30 minutes of constant shooting with two cameras to get this thing actually happening for real. And amazing witnessing Ian do that. And it was a very emotional first sort of pre-shoot day on set.
Fabulous.
Something I would touch on briefly about the visual language of what we wanted to do was we wanted to attempt to humanize beauty. So there can be and this isn't always the case, you know. I think Caleb Deschanel did some amazing work with Black Stallion with horses, and I think there's been some amazing work with animals done before. But what we wanted to try and do with this film was we wanted to try and shoot beauty as if she were a person. So we wanted to design a language so that we had a reciprocal narrative, a visual grammar for beauty, for essentially a horse, based on how we shoot a person. So if we shot a person in profile, we'd shoot beauty in profile. If we had a medium close of a person, we needed a medium close of a horse. We needed reciprocal frames, so that the language, by starting to shoot her in a way that one would subliminally expect a person to be shot, we hope we're able to build a sort of stronger emotional bond with her for an audience. So that was something very interesting, sort of exploring the face and the geography and the architecture of a horse's body. That was very interesting, something we did during prep and then sort of took forward through the shoot. And my B-cam op as well, Dale Rodkin, was just absolutely phenomenal. He was on Steadicam, and Steadicam became a very, very important tool for us because of the fact of, you know, touching earlier on the fact that the horses that, you know, hitting marks was a gray area. So having that being reactionary on the Steadicam gave us that flexibility to be reactive to what the animals were doing.
Sure. And how did, being a studio film, differ from your previous experiences of indie films and working with Netflix? What were the major differences, would you say?
Well, the scale is the first thing that steps up. You know, the size of the crew, the pressure, that side of things is obviously ramped up. We were very fortunate to have Jeremy Bolt and Dylan Tarrison producing, who are incredibly experienced producers with an amazing body of work behind them. And they're very supportive. They're very passionate. And I really felt blessed to be involved in a production where everyone wanted to make the best film possible in a really profound way. The dedication from every single department was quite overwhelming. And I felt that from the first day that I arrived in South Africa and started meeting the team that had already been assembled there. You felt this energy that it was really special. Group of people that they'd brought together. So that was really wonderful. In terms of, I think that's it really.
That's good. I'll have to watch out for it. And you also have another film for the BBC, Make Me Famous, coming out. Again, is there anything that you can just, you know, talk about on that?
Yeah, I can actually. So it's a BBC film directed mm-hmm. by Peter King. Who is a director that I went to film school with. So we actually go back.
Oh, really?
We go back Excellent. 17 years now. So it was wonderful to shoot his debut long form project.
Yeah.
It's a, I believe, very important film about the dangers and effects of social media and celebrity status. The film is, I'm not sure what I'm allowed to say. it's written by Reggie Yates, and it deals with the cause and effect of fast-tracked celebrity status. So it's kind of a piece of social commentary about reality TV and the dangers of fame, the dangers of celebrity status and mental health, the laxing system of support for those people in those positions. It's a film about isolation, loneliness, family. It's a very interesting piece, and it's a very different film from the drama work I've been doing recently, Black Beauty and and The Innocents. We wanted a much more raw aesthetic, a much more real, rougher look. And it's one of those pieces as a cinematographer, you're not pursuing beautiful imagery. You're not pursuing perfecting lighting on characters' faces and making people look great. You're actually just trying to make it feel as real and raw as possible. Again, hoping for that relatability and plausibility in what you're capturing. So yeah, that should be on the BBC imminently. They've not released the transmission dates yet. But it was wonderful collaborating with a director that I've go back so far with and I've worked so much with over my career. It was a really wonderful experience. And the cast were fantastic. We had Tom Brittany as the lead, supported by Emma Rigby and a great, great supporting cast across the board. So, yeah, it was it's a very interesting and important film, I think. We'll see how it's received. I hope it does some good.
I'm sure it sounds really interesting. I'll be watching out for that. So, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap this podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, David. Really, thank you for your time and you know, being with us on the Visual Impact podcast. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for listening to my ramblings. Lovely talking.
Thank you. That was cinematographer David Proctor talking about his work on the Netflix supernatural drama The Innocents. Thanks for listening. You can find more podcasts, blogs and exclusive Visual Impact content by going to our website visuals.co.uk.